This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. An air raid siren was heard in central Kyiv shortly after Polish President Andrzej Duda finished speaking to Ukraine's parliament, a reminder that the nation remained at war even as the front lines have shifted hundreds of kilometers to the south and east. After ending weeks of resistance by the last Ukrainian fighters in the strategic southeastern port of Mariupol, Russia is waging a major offensive in Luhansk, one of two provinces in Donbas. Belarusians are among the foreign fighters who have volunteered to take up arms in Ukraine against Russian forces. VOA's Tommy McNeil has our story.
Many of them consider the Ukrainians defending their homeland to be their brethren. And by joining their resistance to Russia's onslaught, they hope to weaken the rule of Russian President Vladimir Putin and ultimately that of Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko. Some Russian troops were sent from Belarusian territory into Ukraine early in the war, and Lukashenko has publicly stood by longtime ally Putin, calling him his big brother. Weakening Putin, they believe, would create a window of opportunity to topple Lukashenko and bring democratic change to the nation of nearly 10 million people. Tommy McNeil, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Japan Sunday as part of his first visit to Asia as president. A central theme for the trip is to tighten U.S. alliances in the Pacific to counter China's influence in the region. Prior to Japan, Mr. Biden was in South Korea, where he thanked U.S. and South Korean service members.
Our alliance was formed through shared sacrifice in the Korean War, and now, seven decades later, thanks to you, the Republic of Korea is strong, thriving, and innovating democracy, and our alliance grows stronger every single day.
This is VOA News. A military cargo plane carrying the first shipment of infant formula from Europe to help address a critical shortage in the United States landed in the U.S. state of Indiana Sunday, but a top government official noted that much more needs to be done. A February 17th recall by a top baby formula maker and the closing of its manufacturing plant in the U.S. state of Michigan has created one of the biggest infant formula shortages in recent U.S. history for U.S. families. Scientists who have monitored the monkeypox virus in Western Africa are baffled by its recent spread around the world. AP correspondent Karen Chamez reports.
Cases have previously been seen only among people with links to Africa, but in the past week, cases have popped up in Britain, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, the US, and Canada. Most of the reported infections have been found in young men who hadn't previously traveled to Africa. No one has so far died from the outbreak, and scientists in Britain are investigating whether the disease is being sexually transmitted. I'm Karen Chamez.
Austria's first suspected case of monkeypox has been reported in Vienna. National broadcaster ORF said Sunday, citing a spokesperson for the city's top health official. The 35-year-old man was taken to the hospital overnight with symptoms typical of the illness, ORF said, adding that tests should determine later Sunday night whether it was, in fact, monkeypox. Oman announced Sunday the lifting of all measures that had been taken to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in all venues for all activities, state TV reported, citing a statement from the government committee dealing with the pandemic. Authorities in Ethiopia's northern Amhara region have arrested four employees of a U.S.-based online media outlet. While the whereabouts of two others was unclear, the outlet said Sunday, in the latest round of arrests involving media. The arrest would add to those of five journalists in another Amhara media outlet on Thursday over what their colleagues said was the outlet's reporting of the activity of a local volunteer militia known as FANO. Amhara is the second most populous region in Ethiopia and a key constituency for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Northeast Bangladesh's worst floods in nearly 20 years began receding Sunday, but rescue workers were struggling to help millions marooned by extreme weather across the region that has killed around 60 people. Floods are a regular menace to millions of people in low-lying Bangladesh and neighboring northeast India, but many experts say climate change is increasing the frequency, ferocity, and unpredictability. And recapping our top story, an air raid siren was heard in central Kyiv shortly after Polish President Andrzej Duda finished speaking to Ukraine's parliament. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The public is expecting so much from him because backstops at him. While we may indeed expect these law enforcement agents and SCB to act, but obviously we would also want to hear his words on these final findings, and obviously should be able to address the nation.
Malawi civil society and human rights groups demand an inquiry into a report detailing corruption in the government allocation of funds to combat the coronavirus.
And we have those that are prepared to go and set it up for themselves while they are being held on two hands by the SME ministry, the science and technology ministry, as well as the local government ministry that is providing the resources through the CDF.
Zambia's Minister for Labor and Social Security says the administration is implementing measures to create meaningful jobs for the youth.
7 to 15 years, we shouldn't be surprised if China moves ahead and establishes more military facilities on the continent. It should not come as a surprise, judging from the current trajectory of Chinese interest and the expansion of Chinese activities on the continent.
An analyst or expert say it appears China is considering establishing a second naval base in Africa on the Atlantic coast. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Malawi, civil society and human rights groups are demanding an immediate investigation into a report detailing corruption in the government's allocation of funds to combat the coronavirus. This after an audit showed that about $4.7 million of the $21 million of funds to help stop the spread of the disease cannot be accounted for. It adds to the $881 million that could not be accounted for in the first phase of the 2021 study. The findings were contained in a report compiled by Malawi's Auditor General. The groups say those responsible for the alleged misappropriation of funds should be held accountable for their actions. They argue that the alleged embezzlement contributed to COVID-related deaths at the height of the pandemic. Meanwhile, President Lazarus Chakwera has vowed to crack down on those he says are responsible for the alleged graft. For more reaction, I reach Robert Nkwazalemba. He is the chairperson of the Human Rights Consultative Committee.
So there are a number of NGOs that have risen to say we would want action to be done. You may wish to recall that an initial report was released earlier this year, and there were some talks, but government said we would want to wait until we get a final report from the Auditor General. And then some people were suspended, others arrested, some district commissioners. But with this final report being out and confirming the initial report findings, people are saying heads must roll.
Should the Anti-Corruption Bureau, tasked with investigating financial malfeasance or the embezzlement of public funds, be in charge of this? Because sometimes some people say that the anti-corruption group is being used to persecute opponents of the administration. So who should tackle this investigation?
Well, it's on two flanks. You have abuses based on issues to do with subsistence allowance. That is, people being paid the multiple allowances for perhaps for not doing anything. And then you have other issues to do with misprocurements, where you have state entities, the internal procurement committees, colluding to defraud government either by giving false figures or inflated figures. So obviously there are two elements. You have the police have to deal with perhaps the issue of subsistence allowance claims, and then you have to further do investigations and prosecute institutions that are involved in misprocurement, that is the inflation of figures and the like. They need to find out what was the motive, who was behind it, so that they are brought to book. So if such issues are brought to police, they to an extent lack capacity to understand the motive behind such misprocurements, because if there is collusion, parties spoke and they agreed to supply others, And then you also get to find some decisions that were made midway. They were assigned, the initial project was to procure medicine, drugs, issues of sanitizer. But midway, they changed the focus of what the money should be used for. So the person behind the decision to say, can we change course of the project, those people have to be brought to book. So yes, SCB has to be involved. It may have been overstretched or it is being overstretched, but it has to come in on those aspects. Well, police also have to do their part. So we would not want to agree with the elements that perhaps SCB is being used to persecute individuals maybe from the previous administration, if that may be put in that context. But would like to say we understand SCB has moved fast on a few individuals, political individuals, simply because there is evidence that is available. Corruption prosecution is not a small task. So where they have evidence and confirm the trail of abuse or corruption, that's why they have moved fast. And unfortunately, it seems to be addressed to those individuals that were in the previous administration. That's how it's being misunderstood. But we do appreciate and understand that SCB is working based on the information that they have so far gathered on such allegations.
President Lazarus Chakwera has vowed to crack down. What are the expectations of him to undertake this promise to crack down on those responsible for the alleged embezzlement?
Obviously, he may not want to be seen to be overacting his responsibilities. He believes in the high five where the rule of law is one arm of his principles. So he would want state institutions to undertake action. Initially, when he acted, where he fired some district commissioners and the like, the magistrate court found them not wrong and they were reinstated. Obviously, people would have concluded that the president acted wrongly, overstepped his mandate. So we are seeing a scenario where he would say, I tried my part, but the system, justice system, let me down. These people appeared. So based on the final report, let the law enforcement agents act. So obviously, you'll be looking at the police to prosecute and the SCB to take up those matters that are involving individuals where corruption has been detected. So we would say he maintains his stand that he is very club on corruption. The public is expecting so much from him because backstops at him. While we may indeed expect these law enforcement agents and SCB to act, but obviously we would also want to hear his words on these final findings, and obviously should be able to address the nation.
Robert Nkwazalemba is the chairperson of the Human Rights Consultative Committee. He spoke with me from Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. Zambia's Minister for Labour and Social Security says President Hakainde Hichilema's administration has implemented measures to recruit 30,000 teachers and 11,000 nurses before the end of the year. Brenda Tambatamba says he has created an enabling business environment to encourage Zambians to invest and to attract foreign investors in mining and other sectors of the economy. Her remarks follow President Hakainde Hichilema's call for a concerted effort to improve the operating environment of the mining sector. His call came during a speech at the annual African Mining Indaba, recently held in Cape Town, South Africa. For more on the labor market in Zambia, I reached Zambia's Labor and Social Security Minister Brenda Tambatamba via Skype. In part two of my interview with her, Tambatamba addresses concerns by youth groups that government is failing to keep its promises to quickly create jobs for them.
We have got a responsibility to take Zambia out of the doldrums of the debt situation that the PF government entrenched this nation in. So social safety net, managing the debt situation, which is, would become almost unsustainable. And so we've checked, we have assessed, we've done risk assessments, plausible ideas of the best way to manage the debt situation. And so we are negotiating a program with the IMF to restructure the debt so that it doesn't obstruct our agenda to cater to the needs of our people, to creating the jobs that are so much needed. So our people are being communicated to, including communicating to them about the alternatives that are in place that they can utilize in the short term and the midterm while we are pursuing more sustainable long-term economic recovery measures that will yield the kind of jobs, the meaningful jobs that have been demonstrated in the jobs that have been provided, procured for the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education and many more. Including the fact that we are also looking at the social security packages of those that have gone without their pensions during the same time, the past 10 years, who were never paid their pension.
What entails in this safety net? And for those who are not in the health or education industry where the jobs have been created, like you mentioned, what happens to them?
The SME Development Ministry is seated there together with the Ministry of Science and Technology to ensure that they provide a framework for training, for upskilling those that are wishing to go into self-employment.
What kind of training?
Vocational training.
Okay.
Yes, vocational skills training. And so this is the framework that we have. The two ministries are working together with the Ministry of Labor and Social Security, my ministry, to ensure that we are also catering to those that may be crossing from formal employment to go and set up their small businesses that will grow eventually. And that is also complemented by the CDF, the Constituency Development Fund, that has grown exponentially, unprecedented growth. Of that fund from 1.6 million kwacha to 25 million kwacha. This money has two components that these who are being trained can tap from. By the way, there's a component that can give a bursary, that will afford a bursary to those who want to go to the vocational skills training programs. And so that is the social safety net that has been provided. Money for bursaries for vocational training, money to be borrowed by those who are coming out of vocational schools to go and set up their small enterprises, and also a provision for training that is coming from SME Development, continuously carrying them along to train them on financial inclusiveness and many other facets that are important for them to grow their businesses, their small businesses, medium-scale businesses, into responsible, big, growing, you know, developing businesses that will one day become, they will one day mature to become private sector players of the future. Even the CEO of Barrick was quoted as expressing themselves, commenting that there is now a better investment climate in Zambia that will attract even their rethinking about participating, just like FQM has done. So Barrick too, we count on them that they'll be looking. They will be looking to probably expanding their property in Lumwana, while there'll be newcomers that are coming on the block that will also cater to those who are who prefer to be recruited to get employed in the mining sector again. So we have those investors that are coming in, absorbing some of those who are falling off from those that are adjusting, who are going through some business restructuring at the moment. And we have those that are prepared to go and set it up for themselves while they are being held on two hands by the SME Ministry, the Science and Technology Ministry, as well as the local government ministry that is providing the resources through the CDF.
Brenda Tambatamba is Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Analysts or experts say it appears China is considering establishing a second naval base in Africa on the Atlantic coast. They also say due to China's routine denial about its intentions, its credibility in Africa has drawn mixed reaction. This after China on many occasions denied it was establishing a military base in Djibouti. Experts say the yet-to-be-established base will help China project strength and power on the global stage. But the African Union has cautioned its member states not to sign agreements that enable developed nations to establish military bases in their respective countries. Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, recently penned an article about China's speculated plan to establish a second naval base in Africa. I reached him for more on the latest on China's plans.
What my report does is it tries to explain China's thinking in terms of basing scenarios. It provides insight into why China is pursuing expeditionary capabilities. It looks at the record of behavior and the record of practice in terms of indicators that might suggest potential scenarios and options that China might settle for on the African continent. It doesn't exactly state where China is going next, but what it does, or what China is going to do, because that is very difficult and, frankly, it is impossible. However, it provides a set of indicators that policy analysts, researchers, military scholars, and decision makers can use to be able to try and get a better understanding about China's basing doctrine, China's basing practices, and the record of past behavior.
Some say, what is wrong with a China decision to establish yet another naval base in Africa, especially when other world powers have military bases in Africa?
I mentioned this in my report, that other countries have got bases, United States, United Kingdom. I mentioned the United Kingdom one because it's a really huge presence in Kenya, and it's a presence that China does not come anywhere close to having that kind of presence in Africa. You cannot even compare the base that China has in Djibouti and the presence the British Army has had in Kenya since independence. Africans have had a very complicated relationship and a very complicated history with foreign intervention. And foreign intervention and the establishment of bases, whether it's done by China or whether it's done by the US or Russia, tends to be frowned upon by Africans. And some of the evidence that can be cited, and which indeed is cited in the report, is the AU decision. The AU has taken a decision. The AU Peace and Security Council took a decision, first of all, expressing concern and warning member countries to be careful about signing agreements that will establish more foreign bases on the continent.
Paul, some people have also questioned China's thought process, because sometimes they shroud what they want to do in some cloud or mystery, or don't really detail what they plan to do until the last minute, or when it is done before they know. Does this really undermine what they plan to do in terms of the projection of power or try to make friends on the international stage?
I think it does. So yes, indeed. Anytime any story comes up concerning the potential establishment of a Chinese base, African observers tend to go back to that Djibouti experience, and they tend to argue that, listen, China denied this up until the very last minute, so why should we believe? If China then comes up and says, no, we don't have any plans, for instance, to build a base, just out of argument's sake, in Namibia or Kenya or Tanzania, because these are countries that have been cited in the past, then local actors then say, okay, why should we believe you? Because when it came to Djibouti, we saw exactly what happened. So yes, indeed, it does create credibility problems for China. It does create credibility problems. It does create image problems. But I think it will be important to note that just judging from the growth and the expansion of China's geostrategic footprint on the continent, which is growing day by day. I mean, you already have over 10,000 Chinese firms on the continent. About 2,000-3,000 of them are state-owned enterprises. You have all these high-value investments that are being put in place. You also have a growing number of military-to-military cooperation agreements with different African countries. An expansion of Chinese participation in peacekeeping operations. My guess is that within the next 7 to 15 years, we shouldn't be surprised if China moves ahead and establishes more military facilities on the continent, it should not come as a surprise, judging from the current trajectory of Chinese interest and the expansion of Chinese activities on the continent.
Paul Nantulia is a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Sonny. The Men's Basketball Africa League finals continue on Sunday with two quarterfinal games at the Kigali Arena in Rwanda. Joining us now from Kigali to tell us more is viewer Sonny Young. Spotted greetings, Sonny.
What's the atmosphere been like at the Kigali Arena?
Well, Peter, on Saturday at the Kigali Arena, there was a near-capacity crowd of almost 10,000. I did see a few empty seats. Great atmosphere, Peter. The FAP fans from Cameroon were waving the Cameroon flag. The supporters of Rwanda Energy Group, they had trumpets and drums, singing and dancing. I thought it was a wonderful atmosphere. However, the team from Cameroon, FAP, did prevail by a score of 66-63 and left many of the hometown Rwanda fans very disappointed. In the opening day game on Saturday, Petro de Luanda from Angola, one of the continental powers in African men's basketball, they defeated AS Saleh of Morocco by a score of 102-89. Carlos Moraes with a game high 27 points for Petro de Luanda.
Well, Sonny, this new Basketball Africa League is in its second year of existence. Do you think it will grow in terms of participating teams and host cities?
Peter, just to review a little bit, last year the Basketball Africa League held its inaugural season, and it was basically a compressed two-week schedule here in Kigali at the same Kigali Arena. And this time around, they changed the format a bit for the second season. The games began in March in Dakar, Senegal, and then they moved to Cairo, Egypt in April, and now they've wound up here in Kigali for the Basketball Africa League finals. So we had three African cities participating in season 2022 of the Basketball Africa League. I think it is possible, Peter, that we will see more African cities hosting games down the road more African countries for that matter. I know other African countries have expressed interest in hosting the Basketball Africa League games. There are infrastructure questions. Is the arena suitable for hosting games? But, yes, I think we're going to see more teams. This time around, the league started with a total of 12 teams. And one of the teams that's participating on Sunday here in Kigali, the Cape Town Tigers, I've spoken with their coach, Relton Boyson, and he has predicted maybe in a year or two that there could be as many as 20 teams, maybe even more, participating in the Basketball Africa League. So, yes, Peter, I think there is room for future growth.
So, Sonny, what's the impact of the league's partners, talking about the National Basketball Association, the NBA, and FIBA, the International Basketball Federation?
Huge impact, Peter, especially the NBA. I think the NBA really is the driving force for this new Basketball Africa League. The NBA is financing the league. They have even sent some of their organizational people here to Rwanda to help out with media credentialing, hospitality. I think the NBA is definitely, it has a huge impact on the success of this league. I can't underscore enough the financial impact that the NBA is bringing to the Men's Basketball Africa League. And, you know, we even have some ex-NBA players, Peter, participating. here in Kigali. Just to name one, Ike Diagu. He'll be playing for Zamalek on Sunday evening here in Kigali. Ike is a veteran player for Nigeria's national men's team, and he began his professional career with a few years in the NBA. So even players like Ike Diagu, Peter, they bring NBA seasoning, NBA expertise to the Men's Basketball Africa League. They can teach these younger players, and I think that's where the BAL really needs to focus. They need to develop the younger players in Africa, both men and women.
That was my colleague VOA Sunny Young reporting from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, families of people kidnapped from a train in Nigeria's Kaduna State 2 months ago are protesting a decision by authorities to resume service on the railway next week. Officials of the Nigerian Railway Corporation, or NRC, said trains will begin running between the capital Abuja and Kaduna City again on Monday. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital Abuja.
Relatives of kidnapped victims met Thursday morning to protest the planned resumption of train service on the Kaduna-Abuja line. Authorities suspended service indefinitely on March 28th, the day armed men blew up tracks in Kaduna and attacked a train. 9 people were killed during the attack and scores are still missing. During Thursday's protest, the spokesperson of the group, Abdul Fatai Juma, said at least 61 people are believed to be held captive, including Juma's wife. He said the government has been insensitive to the family's plight.
Our relatives kidnapped are still in captivity, and we want them to be free first before they can start thinking of that. We want the MRC management and the Ministry of Transportation to put adequate security measures in place to guarantee the safety of passengers before train services can resume. These are the minimum conditions we require from them.
Ida Hart Yusuf's 2 sisters, both in their 50s, are also among the abducted passengers. She does not understand why the NRC would restart train service.
The national pain is not only the family's pain. So why would they choose to move on like that?
The NRC said the decision to resume operations is not a sign of insensitivity to the situation and said efforts continue to release the captives. Security experts say negotiations have been deadlocked since the kidnappers demanded authorities release members of their gang in exchange for the abductees. Jimo says the families have been given few details about the talks.
We have information from some government sources that discussions are ongoing with the abductors. We just don't know the extent or how far they have gone in these negotiations.
The kidnappers have freed only 3 abductees, including a pregnant woman who told local news organizations that she was freed out of pity. Northern Nigeria has seen a wave of kidnappings for ransom over the past 18 months. This week, police arrested 31 people on charges of abducting students from a school in Kaduna State last year. Authorities also recovered 61 firearms, 376 rounds of ammunition, 22 cartridges, and $5,000 cash. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Morocco's RS Berkane are the champions of the 2021-2022 CAF Confederation Cup. They beat South Africa's Orlando Pirates 5-4 on post-match penalties in the final played at the Goodswill Akapabio Stadium in Uyo, Nigeria. The game was forced into penalties after a 1-1 draw in regulation plus extra time. Pirates forward, then because the lock had mixed fortunes, as he scored an equalizer in the 117th minute, but his penalty was saved in the shootout. He was the only one who missed on Pirates' side, while Bekene converted all their five kicks. In women football, Nigeria and Ghana moved closer to the India 2022 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup qualification with the final round of first leg victories over Ethiopia and Morocco, respectively, on Friday. Nigeria beat Ethiopia in Addis Ababa, while the Ghanaians defeated Morocco 2-0 in Accra. At Abebe Bikala Stadium, Apayemi Ajakaye broke the deadlock with her 36-minute strike. With the first leg lead, the Nigerians will seek to complete their qualification bid when they welcome the East Africans for the second leg at the Mashoud Abiola Stadium in Abuja on June 4th. Elsewhere in Accra, the Black Maidens relied on goals from Stella Anyamieke and Nancy Amor to secure a comfortable lead over the Moroccans at the Accra Sports Stadium. The second leg showdown with the North Africans will be at the Prince Mole Al Hassan Stadium in Rabat, also on June 4th. Meanwhile, three women referees and three women assistant referees were announced on Thursday by FIFA among 129 officials selected for World Cup duty. These women referees will make World Cup history by officiating games at a major men's tournament for the first time in Qatar. According to FIFA, among those announced are Rwanda's Samila Mukansanga and Japanese official Yoshimi Hamashita. The tournament will be played from November 21st to December 18th. And on Thursday, June 16th, FIFA will make major and highly anticipated announcement related to the staging of the FIFA World Cup 2026 across Canada, Mexico, and the United States. 22 candidate host cities are currently vying for the right to stage matches for the 48-team tournament hosted by three nations, and this will be the first time three nations would host the FIFA World Cup. And the 2022 Basket Africa League playoffs and finals began at Kigali Arena in Rwanda on Saturday. They run until May 28th. The top eight teams from the league's Sahara and Nile conferences are competing in a single elimination playoffs and finals, with the winner crowned the second Basketball Africa League champion. On Saturday, Petro de Rwanda and FAP won their games on day one of the quarterfinals. Petro de Rwanda defeated SL 102-89, while FAP beat Rwanda Energy Group REP 66-63. The winners of the quarterfinal matchups will meet in the semifinals on May 25th for the chance to advance to the 2022 BAL finals, which will be held on May 28th. And that's it for this edition of Northern Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. More often than not, when matters pertaining to United Nations peacekeeping are discussed, there is always the emphasis that the major peacekeeping UN forces in Africa are very important and therefore useful to the stability of the continent. Also, with relations to that matter, it is always stressed that the cost of the operations on the continent amounts to billions of US dollars. In fact, there are African citizens who are living in countries where United Nations peacekeeping forces are deployed, who lament the fact that the enormous amount spent on UN peacekeeping in their country should have been used to alleviate poverty, which they consider as one of the underlying causes of conflict. Nevertheless, Africans should be gratified that the UN has played a useful role in the continent. The first peacekeeping force on the Suez Canal and Sinai, 1956 to 1967, and the next in 1973 to 79, played useful role in averting serious international crisis. So too was the UN role in the Congo, called ONUC, from 1960 to 1964, which helped to keep the Congo united despite the efforts of Moise Tshombe to divide the Congo by declaring the independence of Katanga. We must, of course, remember that that operation created a bitter taste for African leaders, because a major prime minister and nationalist, Lumumba, was killed during the operation of ONUC. The UN also played a useful peaceful role in both Liberia and Sierra Leone, although no one should ignore or forget that the fundamental foundation for the stability of those two countries was laid by ECOMOG, ECOWAS peacekeeping machinery. Also, we found out that the UN played a useful role in Namibia for its independence, in South Africa through the transitions from apartheid to black majority rule, to Somalia during the chaotic period after the fall of Said Barre, and in, of course, Rwanda, even though that oppression has left a stain in UN peacekeeping in Africa. But the concern now is what is happening to current United Nations peacekeeping forces on the continent. In Mali, things look so chaotic. What is the real role of a UN peacekeeping force at a time when France, the leading force in that peacekeeping, is leaving because of the request of the government, and those European countries that have been helping to defeat the terrorists in the Sahel are also leaving? And then we have the Wagner group in also Mali. So what really is the real role of UN peacekeeping in Mali? We have a similar problem in the Central Africa. There too, no one can tell really what is going on. You also have the Wagner group in Central Africa. People have doubts about it. But more worrying is the UN peacekeeping force in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. This has been there for years, even decades, and yet problems remain. During the time of President Kabila, efforts were made to withdraw the oppressions from the Congo. However, since the reform of peacekeeping in October 1963, it is no longer the call of the host government for the withdrawal of peacekeeping. That should be left only to the Security Council. UN peacekeeping also played a very important role in dealing with elections. For example, it was in Eritrea. Now, when you also look at southern South Sudan, the UN force has played a role, but you are hearing something which we have heard so often in the Congo. In Ituri province, eastern Congo, you have rebel forces killing each other. Civilians are being killed in large numbers, although they have not yet hit the international media. Particularly, children are being killed in Ituri province. They are fighting for the mining of gold. And yet, you don't hear about the role of the UN peacekeeping to stop this killing. A few months ago, the forces of Uganda, with the agreement of the president of Congo, came in to help in eastern Congo to stop all of this killing, but that force is now withdrawing. The president of Rwanda has also volunteered to send troops to Eastern Congo to maintain stability, but that has not yet come to fruition. But the real question is, what is the role of the United Nations peacekeeping force in the Congo after decades of presence in that country? Just last week, an official of South Sudan government raised this same issue of what is the effect of UN peacekeeping. The official noted that his government has taken a decision to enter Abyei, a territory that has caused a lot of problems in the past in negotiations. There is no agreement between the Sudan and South Sudan as to who owns that territory. The matter should have been resolved by a referendum, but since there has not been any agreement as to who should participate, Abyei remains a contested territory. What will happen if South Sudan sent troops into this territory? This may light a flash and cause problems. So why is the role of the UN? Because according to the South Sudanese, UN peacekeeping has not been playing its proper role. In the circumstances, it may be useful for the Secretary General of the United Nations to designate either one of its senior staff or an outside consultant who knows about peacekeeping to take a look at all these peacekeeping forces now going on in Africa to determine how best to make them effective and useful. Unless this is done, we may have a situation where Africans begin to look at UN peacekeeping in the way our founding fathers ended up looking at ONUC, the operation in the Congo, 1960-1964. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Wake up.
Kill a gummy bomb that came out of the same way, don't mind. When I land, I land. know I'm done trying. It's a person in my baby, nothing can equate to you. You tied on my life, switched off my worries, baby. Baby in my passport, Superman, gentleman, my super. Come on, to go in a quarter.
Yeah. nakutaka kwetaka nakuhitaji.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, leave the truth that can ruin a marriage unsaid. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.